episode 33, Cleomene, Sparta. Aristotle wrote, in his work known as the Politics, the following in relation to Spartan kingship. As to kingship, we may postpone considering whether states are better off with or without it. At any rate, they would do better not to have kings after the present Spartan fashion. We say that in every case, a king should be chosen in light of his personal life. It is clear that even the Spartan lawgiver himself does not believe it possible to produce kings of first quality. At all events, he has no confidence that they are good enough. This explains why they used to send their personal enemies to accompany them as ambassadors, and why they regarded disagreement between the two kings as making for stability in the state. Although this translation is slightly dated, the message is clear. Aristotle did not place a great amount of stock in the dignity of Spartan hereditary kingship, and by the lawgivers, that is Lycurgus's own devices, they were set against each other, and often also against the other branches of government. Born in the year 384 BCE in the northern Greek city of Stagira, Aristotle was only 13 years old at the time of Sparta's crushing defeat on the fields of Leuctra in 371. Therefore, we need to explicate his often negative views of Sparta against the period. By the time he was writing prolifically in his Athenian Lyceum, the Lacedaemonian state was a pale shadow of its former self, descending into licentiousness, avarice, and internal discord throughout the latter half of the 4th century. It was a long way from its former heyday. Eunomia, that is good order, no longer swept through the broad streets of the city. That being said, he certainly wasn't incorrect in his description of Spartan kingship, not entirely. To Aristotle, Spartan regal authority was almost purely titular in nature. Little better than hereditary generals, he gives the impression Spartan kings were a relic, an appendix that the state would have benefited by excising the position entirely. In his time, this was perhaps wholly true. But when those generals had at their disposal the most powerful fighting force in Greece, then the prerogative of leadership should not be understated in its importance. The polymath cites as Lycurgus's intention to hobble the kingship via his reform package, making the two royal houses merely part of the deliberative gerontocracy, two of the council's 30 members. Furthermore, the personal enemies referred to by Aristotle, the Ephorate, held a preponderance of power within the state, and two of the board travelled everywhere with the kings whilst on campaign, looking for any action or utterance worthy of denouncement. The gradual assumption of royal power into bodies more broad, more inclusive in their makeup, is a common function for all forms of rule that begin as absolute monarchies. Authoritative kings are able to hold on to a plenitude of power, but the weaker ones, who seek to maintain their throne, are forced to give concessions to their apparent lessers. This process is repeated over time, until monarchies become irrelevant, unimportant, and then nominal in function. The English monarchy is a perfect example of this. Founded by William the Conqueror in 1066, post the Battle of Hastings, there would, save title, be little to compare between his power and that of his distant relative, the current Queen Elizabeth II. Although still extremely important to the psyche of the modern Englishman or woman, her position is mostly symbolic now. A figurehead of prestige, correctness, service, and dignity. It is clear from King William's epithet that he had hard power to exercise in the name of his own interests. It has been some time since the English monarch had such power. Another, perhaps more salient, example is that of the French monarchy, which despite having a great many living descendants, is no longer functional, or for that matter even recognized in any way, shape or form by the French government. From its lofty beginnings with Charles the Great, more popularly known as Charlemagne, the Carolingian Empire was perhaps the most powerful and prestigious European dynasty since the collapse of the Caesars. Even becoming the spiritual successor to the Romans with Charlemagne's coronation as Holy Roman Emperor in the year 800. Though Voltaire, with his customary wit, points out that this was neither holy nor Roman, or for that matter, even a true empire. Either way, the power of this throne steadily decreased over the years until it saw its figurehead literally lose his head to the guillotine on January the 21st, 1793, as the French Revolution really began to gather some steam. Other examples abound. Take the Chinese emperors, for example, the proverbial sons of heaven who received their mandate from the gods themselves, a position hollowed out over the years until a mere puppet sat upon the dragon throne, practically locked up within the Forbidden City. However, it would be fair to say that the Chinese people replaced a paper autocrat with real and terrible ones in the form of the communist leaders it has seen since the last emperor was forced to abdicate. The Japanese imperial system had a similar turn of fortune, though still remains in an almost purely ceremonial fashion today, it must be said. These generalizations of the progressive degradation of monarchic power across the globe serve to paint the broad picture, but of course, and as always, there is nuance that is worthwhile probing. Occasionally, in spite or despite of the concessions offered to other levels of power, a ruler rose who through sheer prestige and dominance ran roughshod over all the checks and balances put in place over the centuries to curtail royal prerogative. Louis XIV, aka the Sun King, was one such ruler. A proponent for the divine right of kings, he centralized the power within his capital that had slowly crept away from the throne. An absolute monarch who fulfilled that definition absolutely. During his reign, France became a byword for military might and religious piety. Louis's reign was incredibly long and just as distinguished. Cleomenes I was another such king. Royal power had been severely diluted since the time of Sparta's foundation. First one king became two, then those two became merely part of a ruling body of elders, which in form at least required democratic consent to function properly. Last but not least, the ephors, or as Aristotle put it, the enemies of the kings, were set up as their adjudicators of all actions within the state. Cleomenes knocked aside every one of these measures and seems for the most part to have had almost dictatorial powers over Spartan affairs. In spite of attempts by the anti-Cleomenian party, headed by the Eurypontid king Demaratus, to thwart the Argead king's will, Cleomenes controlled Spartan policy and set them upon a path to greatness at the fields of Thermopylae and Plataea. This is his story. A little digression first. I'd been struggling to translate the name of Cleomenes' father, King Anaxandridas, so I reached out to the host of Ancient Greece Declassified, Lantern Jack, for some assistance. If somehow you've missed his show, please do check it out. It's fantastic. He's currently going through Plato's Republic, book by book. It's a great intro to Plato's work if you've never gone down the rabbit hole before. Jack's breakdown of the name led to some interesting discoveries of my own. So, Anax means king, Andra means man, and Ethus means son of. Therefore, Anaxandridas means the son of Anaxandros, which in turn means the king of men. Strangely, Anaxandridas wasn't the son of Anaxandros, who ruled in the mid-7th century, making his namesake, Anaxandridas, his great-grandson. Figure that one out if you can. It should be said, the Greeks weren't too fussed with lineal descent when it came to names, and for Anaxandridas, it would be enough to emulate the spirit of his great-grandfather, the king of men. Last point of interest, and the main reason why I couldn't translate the name to begin with, is the Greek word for king. I took this to be basileus, a word you often see associated with king in the Hellenistic period and onwards. Though we are still dealing with the archaic version of the language, that is a great many relics of Mycenaean Greek, so the word anax derives from the Bronze Age form for king, wanax. Brilliant! Okay, back to the matter at hand. We briefly went over the genesis of Cleomenes in the last episode. Due to the nature of his conception and birth having some bearing on his kingly succession, the events warrant another closer look. King Anaxandridas, ruling from 560 to 524, had some succession issues, so the story goes. Namely, that he sat upon the throne for an undefined period of time without bearing an heir. The ephorate, heavily influenced by the powerful Helon, demanded the king take a second wife in order to fulfill his monarchic responsibilities. The sources tell us that this new wife was a relative of Helon, the famous sage. The union quickly achieved its desired result with the birth of a son. He was given the name Cleomenes, or glorious strength in English, from the Greek words Cleo and Manos, glory and force, respectively. His duties fulfilled, Anaxandridas promptly returned to his first wife. Was it love and devotion that sent him back? Maybe. But scholars place the pro-Achaean policy the Spartans pursued during the 6th century and the formation of the Peloponnesian League squarely at the feet of Helon. It is assumed that Anaxandridas rejected this policy, along with Helon's relative, his second wife. The king promptly went on to father 3 sons with his original wife, the first of which was named Dorius, meaning the Dorian. It is assumed that this bears out the schism between the pro-Achaean policy of Helon and the pro-Dorian or nationalist policy of Anaxandridas. It seems as though the king was trying to bind this new lineage firmly within the roots of the Lacedaemonian people. Briefly, it should be noted that the academic theory of a policy schism at the heart of Spartan politics rests on extremely unstable ground, especially if we consider that Lacedaemonian fascination with pro-Achaean, that is Homeric mythology, goes back almost 150 years before Helon's primacy with the consecration of the Menelaon and sanctuary to Helen at Therapne. Anaxandridas also went on to have 2 more boys with his original wife. The second was Leonidas, or Son of the Lion. I, for obvious reasons, love that name. The third was called Cleombrotus, which translates as Glorious Addition, so it can be safely assumed that this son was an unexpected, though treasured, supplement to the royal family unit. For members of the homoioi class who wished their children to achieve full enfranchisement, the requisite path was through the agoge. There was only one exception allowed, and that was for the heirs apparent. It isn't spelt out exactly why this would be the case, but enough reasons present themselves as to provide a likely explanation. The agoge was brutal, and there are recordings of children expiring during its term. With limited royal children available, it wouldn't do to sacrifice them on the altar of the Spartan educational program. Furthermore, how would it look if the future king had failed to pass the tests? How could any warlike people submit to the rule of such weakness, such failure? Lastly, as a descendant of the hero Heracles, the exemption might be seen as simply sheer exceptionalism on behalf of the royal heir, due to his pedigree. Whatever the reasoning, Cleomenes was forwarded a get-out-of-jail-free card when it came to the agoge. His half-brothers were not. On the death of Anaxandridas, this exclusion became a problem for Cleomenes in regards to his right of succession. When it came time to crown the new Argead king, a challenge was issued by his half-brother, the next in line to the throne, Dorius. His claim was superior andragathi, which translates as manliness. Professor Paul Cartledge attributes this claim to 2 factors. The first and most likely would be the young Dorius's performance throughout the grueling agoge. The second, though plausible, is impossible to verify, that Cleomenes' half-brother fought bravely in the failed invasion of Samos in 525, which we looked at in depth last episode. These factors are supported by Herodotus, who in the histories states that Dorius was the finest man of his generation. In fairness, it should be said that Herodotus was thoroughly anti-Cleomenes, labelling the king as addled of mind and on the brink of madness. In a society renowned for its bellicose attitude, as Sparta surely was, the charge of unmanliness was a serious one. In retort, Cleomenes reiterated his birth as the firstborn son of the dead king. Bellicosity aside, Sparta was renowned even more for its respective traditions, and Cleomenes was promptly installed on the Argead throne. Having been foiled first by birth and then by the Moors of Lacedaemon, Dorius decided that Sparta simply wasn't big enough for he and his elder half-brother. Denied the throne, he consulted the Gerousia, requesting them to select a body of men with which he could found a colony elsewhere. His request was granted by the august body, of which Cleomenes, as king, was now part of. We aren't told explicitly the makeup of this expedition, though I would suggest it was made up in small part by homoioi, who were firmly in Dorius's camp and who had staked their future with him as their king. But for the most part, it was surely perioikoi, who had the right of freedom of movement and thought it best to try a fresh start in new lands. As property of the state, first and foremost, I think it unlikely that any large number of helots joined, albeit forcibly, the new venture. The oliganthropia that went on to beset the Spartans predominantly in the 5th and 4th centuries was even now, in the mid-6th century, rearing its disastrous head. The fact of Anaxandridas being practically forced to take on a second wife to ensure succession of the Argead line supports that. Oliganthropia was coined by Aristotle, and was a word the polymath used to describe the issue of population decline within Spartan's ruling elite. It translates roughly as a fewness of people. So it was that Dorius and his merry band of settlers set sail to the south. But as the ever-pious Herodotus notes, they went without official Delphic consent. They stopped in Thera, or Santorini, and collected some supplies and guides before continuing on. As discussed in an earlier episode, the island was in ancient times widely believed to be a colony of Sparta, though this is discounted by most academics today. Next stop was in the Tripolitania region of modern Libya, where they founded their colony along the river called Kynops. Barely 3 years later, a Libyan tribe, along with some Carthaginian allies, drove them out, forcing Dorius and co. to return to the Peloponnese with their tails between their collective legs. In Sparta, nothing had changed, save his rival, Cleomenes, was now well and truly installed on his throne and was already proving to be a dominant force in Laconian politics. Not letting failure get in the way of his dreams, Dorius planned another adventure in search of a new colony. This time, however, and with the praise of Herodotus, he sought and received Delphic condonement and advice. The oracle informed the would-be coloniser that the island of Sicily was at one stage claimed by Heracles, and as such was the rightful inheritance of the Heraclidae. Sailing along with the survivors of his previous journey, Dorius landed in the western region of the island, nearby the ancient city of Segesta. Here, and soon after, his forces were attacked by the local people known as the Elymians and their allies, / overlords, those pesky Carthaginians. Dorius and most of his followers lost their lives in the ensuing battle in around 510 BCE. Uncle H is quick to point out that had Dorius obeyed the oracle to the letter, all would have been fine. But on the way to Sicily, the Spartan prince involved himself in some internecine warfare on the Entellian Peninsula, and thus not strictly adhering to Apollo's wisdom. It seems a very strange route indeed to sail to Sicily via Italy from the Peloponnese, but there you have it, the story of Dorius's demise. If we back up the timeline slightly to around 519, and shift our gaze back to Sparta, we can observe the first recorded kingly exploit of Cleomenes. Recorded by both Herodotus and Thucydides, the event shows how even at this early point the Lacedaemonians had begun assuming some form of real Peloponnesian hegemony. It's unclear why, but Cleomenes, likely at the head of an army, finds himself in the region of Plataea. The polis, most popularly remembered as the site of the famous Greek victory of 479, was situated on the most obvious land route between Athens and Thebes, being barely 12 kilometres south of the latter place. It was geographically and culturally Boeotian, and therefore its allegiance was claimed by Thebes. The Plataeans were dissatisfied with the status quo and appealed to the Spartan king for an alliance. Cleomenes was extremely conservative when it came to affairs outside of the Peloponnese, particularly at this early stage of his kingship, and he rejected the offer, out of hand. Instead, he recommended them make overtures to the Athenians, who welcomed them with open arms. It was a stroke of diplomatic genius on behalf of the Argead king. On the one hand, he had prevented Sparta's greatest rival at the time, a Theban-led Boeotian power block, from attaining another jewel in his crown, and on the other hand, engendered further good relations with Athens, which the Spartans were on exceedingly good terms with at this date. Well, they were on good terms with the current tyrant of Athens, the Pisistrate Hippias, son of the tyranny's founder, Pisistratus. This relationship flew in the face of Sparta's reputation as tyrant killers, but as we'll see, Cleomenes went to extremely bold lengths to ensure and secure the reign of tyrants in Athens. Regardless, it was indeed good policy on behalf of the king, as it set Theban and Athenian against one another, which gave the Spartans the freedom they needed to consolidate their stranglehold on the Peloponnese. As for what the Spartans were doing in the region at the time, we can only speculate. It's possible they were there to bring the polis of Megara within the league, which although to the south of the Plataea, nonetheless bordered the territory. There is also a chance they were marching north to assist the Thessalians in their war against Thebes that had been ongoing since the mid-6th century. Certainly, having Plataea go over to the Athenian side could only have hurt Thebes in those conflicts. Both theories are plausible. What's truly important here is that Sparta felt confident enough within her home range to play politics outside of the Peloponnese and involve herself in the affairs of Hellas more broadly. Moreover, Cleomenes felt secure enough to dictate policy without any consultation with the Gerousia or Ephorid. The next event of note is spelt out by a recording of Plutarch in his Apophthegmata Laconica, or Sayings of Spartans. Although the biographer never wrote a life for Cleomenes, the bulk of information recorded about him seems to have been essay notes designed for the purpose of an unrealised biography. Rather than the strictly recorded utterances attributed to the subject at hand, The 16th recording for the Argead King reads as follows. After Meandrius, the tyrant of Samos, had fled to Sparta because of the Persians' onslaught and displayed all the gold and silver goblets which he had brought, he freely offered Cleomenes as many as he wanted. But he accepted none, and took equal care that Meandrius should not present them to any other citizens. He went to the ephors, and said that it would be better for Sparta if his Samian guests should leave the Peloponnese, so as not to influence any of the Spartiates into becoming a bad character. They took his advice, and proclaimed Meandrius's banishment on the same day. We'll break that down in a moment, but first, let's understand the situation in Samos, since we last looked at it. Polycrates, whom the Spartans and Corinthians had attempted to unseat via a transmarine invasion in the year 525, had been assassinated by the year 520. His secretary, Meandrius, assumed the title of tyrant for himself, but was, in theory at least, of a thoroughly democratic demeanour. His attempts to restore power to the people vexed the oligarchic faction, who had done quite well under the rule of Polycrates. Faced with plutocratic rebellion at home, and a Persian empire to the east that was slowly gobbling up the various bastions of Hellenism in the western Anatolian region, Meandrius took sail to Sparta. That he should do so will come as no surprise to you, my listeners, as we looked at that special relationship between the two places in our previous episode. Unlike in 525 BCE, this time, a Samian wasn't able to convince Sparta, or more specifically, Cleomenes, to provide relief to Samos. His eviction from the Peloponnese is the last we hear of poor Meandrius, but it is assumed that he either went into permanent exile, or more likely, was killed upon his return to Samos. One of his brothers was installed as a puppet ruler by the Persians at a later date, but that is neither here nor there. Riven with internal discord, the Samians could offer little resistance to the Persians and were conquered and brought promptly within the Achaemenid fold. Rejecting both their apparent saviour and the oligarchic faction too, it seems to have been, in the words of Herodotus, that they apparently did not want to be free. The year given for Meandrius's visit to Lacedaemon is 516 BCE. Plutarch is explicit in his recording that the embassy was seen and presided over directly by Cleomenes, not by the Gerousia, nor the Ephorate. The aged Europontid king, Ariston, doesn't even get a mention. No, it is to Cleomenes, and he alone, that the Samian delegation attempts to win over. Moreover, the personal enemies of the kings, as Aristotle puts it, the Ephorate, seem to be at his beck and call for an issue that would normally be the purview of the board, that of corruption. In this instance, it wasn't the Ephors, the people ostensibly responsible for the moral fibre of Sparta, but Cleomenes, who took steps to ensure Samian riches when able to exploit the frugal Spartans, and instructed that Meandrius should be banished. The instruction of banishment was not just for the city, though. Cleomenes requested that the Samian be removed from the Peloponnese itself, another indication that by this time the Laconians considered the peninsula their personal fiefdom. Unfortunately for the people of Samos, special relationship or not, and for reasons that aren't entirely clear to us now, Cleomenes had no interest in becoming embroiled in affairs so far removed from Laconia, when barely a decade before they had done just that. Herodotus also records another embassy being received by Cleomenes in Sparta, this time in the year 514. In this instance, it was a Scythian delegation. This must have been quite the novelty for the Spartans of the late 6th century. Scythia, for the Greeks at least, was considered to be the vast steppe lands to the north and east of the Black Sea, and was peopled with several hardy nomadic tribes who were collectively considered the Scythians. The range of these peoples covered what we call today parts of Kazakhstan, the southern Russian steppes of the Volga, Ural, and Siberia, and also parts of eastern Ukraine. If the story is true, it really speaks to the projection of Sparta at this point in history. Long plagued by Scythian raids into the northern parts of their empire, the Persians, under Darius, resolved to put the stop to them by force. In the year 512, according to Herodotus, the Persians invaded Scythia with an army of 700,000 troops. Such a force took a long time to assemble, as any force did for the Persians, being a largely heterogeneous empire. This gave the Scythians plenty of time to prepare. It was in that vein that the envoy went to Sparta seeking Laconian aid. As with the Samians, Cleomenes rebuffed this request too. Though Herodotus tells us that the Spartan king spent plenty of time with the Scythians and adopted their habit of drinking wine neat, That is without being mixed with water. You see, the modern Greek word for wine is klasi, coming from the ancient Greek word klasis, which actually means to mix. Ancient wine was so potent that it needed to be mixed with water, sometimes at a ratio of one part wine to 10 parts water, sometimes even more diluted. The Spartans were unlike other Greeks in that they celebrated no symposiums or wine parties. Wine was surely taken during meals, but never to excess, and drunkenness was looked upon unfavourably as the pastime of mere helots. The possibility of Cleomenes taking his wine neat will come to play a part later in his story. So, by 514, things seemed to be travelling along rather well for Cleomenes. A check and balance to his reign had recently appeared on the opposing throne of Sparta, though. The year previously, King Ariston finally passed, and his son, Demaratus, assumed the Eriponted throne. Like his Argead counterpart, the event was marred by no small amount of controversy concerning the legitimacy of Demaratus's rule. Ariston had contracted into 2 childless marriages whilst younger and still very much alive. Infertility was, misogynistically so in the minds of ancient Greeks, the fault of womenfolk. It would never have occurred to Ariston that he was the reason for his barren relationships. He just hadn't found the right woman as of yet. But in time, he found the right woman. Inconveniently, she was already married to Agetes, a friend of the king. Haunted by his feelings, day and night, Ariston concocted a foul plan through which he would gain his desire. Going to Agetes, he offered his friend anything of his choosing, should the offer be reciprocated. Knowing that Ariston was already married, Agetes didn't consider the possibility the king should ask for his wife, so the deal was struck. After delivering up whatever Agetes had asked for, Ariston asked for his friend's wife in return. Indignant, cheated, but nonetheless sworn under oath, Agetes divorced his wife, who promptly went into the household of the incumbent Eriponted king. This nameless woman is the same one who was born incredibly plain, and through a visitation by an apparition of Helen, was made into the most beautiful woman Sparta had produced in generations. Herodotus tells us that she was pregnant immediately, and when news of her giving birth reached the king and council, Ariston was stupefied by how early it had happened. We get a picture of the king sitting on his state chair, counting his fingers, and coming up with 7 rather than 10 months. The Greeks counted inclusively in this regard, so for us it would be 9 months. There, before the Gerousia and the Ephors, Ariston exclaimed that the child could not be his. He apparently softened his look over the coming years, and came to believe the son truly was his, but this question of legitimacy came back to haunt the babe. The mother, perhaps seeking to engender love of the child within the community and the king's mind, named him Demaratus, or Beloved of the People. Ascending the Eriponted throne in 515, Demaratus would become the nexus of the anti-Cleomenian party. But he went above and beyond the standard antipathy Spartan kings had for each other. As Aristotle explains, the Spartans considered disagreement between the kings as essential to the stability of state. Demaratus really ratcheted it up, and as we'll see, things got extremely personal between the 2 kings, resulting in the only natural conclusion to such feuds, the downfall of one or the other. The feud first played out in affairs surrounding the governance of Athens, so it behooves us to now take a brief look at the political landscape there during the 6th century. For the bulk of the first half of that century, the common Athenians had laboured under the reforms of Solon, a lawgiver of the first rate to be sure, but his stratification of society, along with his moral and constitutional reforms, ensured that most of the benefits fell squarely upon the anointed heads of the wealthy and often despotic Athenian oligarchy. As in other places with similar styles of government, the city of Athena became a fertile garden bed for demagoguery and dictatorship. These came in the form of Pisistratus, an Athenian general who had no small measure of success against nearby Megara. By hook or by crook, Pisistratus orchestrated a situation whereby he was granted by the Athenian people a personal troop of bodyguards. With this, and with the popular support he had gained as champion of the common man against the societal elite, he took power, installing himself as a tyrant. The oligarchic factions, led by Megacles, a member of the powerful Alcmaeonid family, rallied against the usurper's power. They even managed to exile Pisistratus twice over the next decade, but he returned each time more powerful than the last. Until finally, he returned for good in the year 547, and the Alcmeonids, along with the rest of the oligarchic faction, had no choice but to submit to the highly popular rule of the tyrant. Pisistratus died in 527, and his eldest son, Hippias, became his successor. He ruled with the help of his brother, Hipparchus, in a fashion not dissimilar to their father's. Tactical marriages, popular support, nepotism, and when necessary, brutal force against their enemies. Their rule was, however, like their father's, popular amongst the non-noble Athenians, who generally saw tyranny as preferable to getting caught up in the regular tribal wars of the city's elites. This all changed in 514, when the Pisistrati, the sons of Pisistratus, were attacked by a pair of Athenian lovers who were called Harmodius and Aristogiton. At the heart of the attack lie a sordid tale of unrequited homosexual affection between the rulers and the lovers, but the end result was not a complete success. They managed to kill Hipparchus, the junior partner in the city's governance, but not Hippias. For their crime, the two lovers were executed. The story goes that this event turned Hippias' reign from one of relative benevolence to one more in line with your stereotypical tyranny. I feel this is more likely Alcmeonid propaganda after the fact, who sought to paint the tyranny in as bad a light as possible, paving their way for their own grasp at power. Whatever truly occurred by 511, the Alcmeonid faction was ready to pull out all the stops in trying to overthrow the unconstitutional reign of Hippias. They were led by Clisthenes. He was the son of the previously mentioned Megacles, and the grandson of Clisthenes of Sicyon, who we looked at briefly two episodes previous. Along with undermining the popular support held by Hippias, Clisthenes bribed the oracle of Apollo at Delphi to help gain the assistance of Sparta. Whenever the Spartans sought Delphic prophecy, which they did often, they were always told the same thing. They needed to rid Athens of the Pisistratid dynasty. These Delphic proclamations were extremely problematic for Cleomenes, who didn't really have a problem with the Pisistratid rule in Athens, and moreover, had by his own actions in the past seemed to promote it. He could hardly ignore the utterances of the Pythia. Well, he probably could personally, but the ever-pious Spartans certainly could not. It was decided that Apollo's will had to be obeyed, and an expeditionary force was prepared to assist the Athenians against Hippias. The makeup of this force shows that the Spartans, or Cleomenes at least, wasn't all in on removing Hippias. Rather than one of the kings, as was custom, the overall command was given to a Spartiate called Enhimulus. It is possible that Enhimulus was the first navarch, or at least the first recorded one, for the Spartans. The position means leader of ships, and it would go on to be one of the most powerful postings outside of their hereditary kingships. As leader of the ships, Enhimulus transported his army by sea rather than land. Never being a great naval power in these days, it can be safely assumed that the invasion force was a small one indeed. It isn't understood why the Spartans didn't take the overland route to begin with, as the Peloponnese was firmly in their power, and the only city not properly aligned on the route to Athens, Megara, was generally hostile towards their eastern neighbour. Regardless, the force set sail and landed at the ancient port of Phalerum, some 5 miles to the southwest of Athens. They must have been held up for quite some time, as Hippias managed to find the time to rally his forces, hire 1,000 mercenary cavalry from Thessaly, and clear some ground suitable to cavalry manoeuvres. The Spartans were utterly unprepared to face cavalry and were crushed on the battlefield, the survivors fleeing back to their ships. Among the dead on the Spartan side was their commander, Enhimulus. And the first invasion of Attica came to a close. The next year, 510, Cleomenes sent a much larger force, and this time sent it by land, with he as overall commander. The army first confronted the Thessalian cavalry on the borders of Attica, and routed them with many dead. The survivors were last seen fleeing back north to Thessaly. Then the Spartans were admitted to the city of Athens by a compliant populace and besieged Hippias and his forces, encircling them on the Acropolis. Herodotus states that Cleomenes and his Lacedaemonians were ill-prepared for a siege, and besides, Hippias had laid in good stores for such an event on an easily defended position. By chance, though, the children of Hippias came into the possession of Cleomenes as they were being smuggled out of the city. With them as leverage, Hippias surrendered his tyranny immediately. From there, the survivors of the Pisistratid clan Mediast, going over to the Persians, where they were given lands and titles. In this final act, we might get a closer look at the truth behind Cleomenes' involvement in the affairs of Athens. He was never the most religiously observant of individuals, save where it benefited him. Delphic persistence aside, though, the Spartan king was by the end of his reign thoroughly anti-Persian in his rhetoric and actions. As the situation in Athens began to turn against him, particularly after the assassination of his brother, Hippias sought to ingratiate himself with the Eastern Empire and bonded his family to the Achaemenid dynasty through marital ties. It is imagined by some scholars that the actions of Cleomenes here were the first signs of his anti-Persian policies, though it must be said, we don't get a clear indication of that until much later. Returning to Sparta, Cleomenes left the Athenians up to their own devices, now having fulfilled the ill-gotten wishes of the Delphic oracle. Clisthenes and another powerful Athenian aristocrat, Isagoras, wrestled for control of the city via several, often bloody, factional disputes. Isagoras was extremely popular among the city's ruling elite, but Clisthenes, taking a leaf out of Pisistratus' book, courted popular support and forced through what can only be described as early democratic reforms. Outmaneuvered on the popular front, Isagoras pleaded to Cleomenes, who he had developed a guest friendship with during the previous siege of Athens. The Spartans, seeing a great evil in the seeds of democracy, acquiesced to the request for aid, and Cleomenes marched once more at the head of an army to Athens. Once there, at the suggestion of Isagoras, Cleomenes exiled Clisthenes and his Alcmaeonid clan, along with 700 other families of notable opposition. To ensure the continuance of Isagoras' rule, the Spartan king also abolished the Council of the Boulae, which was set up by Clisthenes to give more power to the citizens, and installed himself and his army on the Acropolis. These actions by the Spartan king incensed the regular Athenians, who by sheer strength of numbers were the true power in the city now. They attacked Cleomenes on his lofty redoubt, forcing his army to flee through the city and back to Sparta. Cleomenes escaped, but many Spartans were captured during the action and were later executed. The Athenians then recalled the exiled Alcmaeonids and the other nobles, and, aware of the fact they were now at war with Cleomenes and Sparta, began preparing for another attack. Embarrassed, and rightfully so, the Spartan king this time raised another army, along with the Peloponnesian League levy, and in the year 506, launched a full-blown invasion of Athens. The goal was to reinstall Isagoras to power, who had escaped with the Spartan king on his flight from Athens previous. All went swimmingly for the force until it reached the vicinity of Eleusis, some 14 miles west of Athens. Here, the invasion was turned into a fiasco that seems to have been largely organized and contrived by the Eurypontic king Demaratus, who was also in command with his co-king. First, the Corinthians, likely convinced by Demaratus, declared that the venture was impious and ignoble, and left the army. Secondly, Demaratus himself decided he was done with the invasion and returned to Sparta. This left the force weakened and split the command structure. Cleomenes had little choice but to return to Lacedaemon in humiliation. This rift, at the top of the command structure, forced a new law into the constitution of the Spartans. From that day forth, only one king could lead an army at any one time. It's a fair assumption that this new reform was put forward by Cleomenes. He tried one last time to reinstate Isagoras into power at Athens, and in the next year he called together a council of the Peloponnesian League. The suggestion of war was voted down by a majority of League allies, with Corinth at their head. This is considered the first true act of the League, and established the precedent of majority support for any call-up of the League levy. Free from Spartan interference, at least for the moment, Clisthenes instituted a series of reforms that gave birth to the first democracy, or power of the people-styled governance, in ancient Greece. It should be noted that other places, including Sparta, are often associated with early forms of democracy, but the popular view amongst academics, and one that I share, is that it was Athens that first got the formula right. Or right to the extent that we recognise ancient forms of democracy when compared with our own today. The entire Athenian affair was extremely embarrassing for Cleomenes. He had ultimately failed in all of his designs, and played a major hand in the creation of democracy to boot. His co-king was assuredly gaining in popularity amongst the opposing faction as well. It is a tribute to the dynamism of Cleomenes that by as early as 499, he was ascendant once more in Spartan affairs. It was the year that Aristagoras, the tyrant of Miletus, arrived in Greece to request aid in his planned revolt from Persian overlordship. This was the beginning of the Ionian Revolt, an event that would set Greece down the path to war against the Persians. As the most powerful force in Greece, it was only natural that Aristagoras first attempted to sway the Spartans to his cause. Once there, he appealed directly to King Cleomenes as the veritable voice of Sparta. The Milesian spoke, and spoke well, telling the Spartans that the Persians would be easy to defeat as they wore trousers and turbans, hardly the outfit of a brave warrior society. He also tempted them with tales of Persian wealth. Hearing enough, Cleomenes asked the Milesian to wait for 2 days, and he would have his answer. After the 2 days had elapsed, king and tyrant met once more, and Cleomenes had one final question. He asked how far the Persian capital, Susa, was from Miletus. When informed that it was 90 days' march altogether, Cleomenes immediately refused the request for aid, stating that it was simply too far distant for his armies to march when they had enemies far closer than that. Herodotus tells a story about Aristagoras then attempting to bribe Cleomenes with offers of gold and silver. And in the story, it was the king's daughter, Gorgo, who convinced her father of the envoy's corrupting influence. Gorgo, which means terrifying in English, is an interesting, though like many other Laconian women, an ephemeral figure in Spartan history. Plutarch amazingly records several of her sayings, and two are pertinent to this meeting between Cleomenes and Aristagoras. The first relates to the alleged bribery attempt, and reads as follows. When the Milesian, Aristagoras, was urging Cleomenes to make war against the great king in support of the Ionians, and was promising quantities of money, and adding more to meet his objections, the king's daughter, Gorgo, said, "Father, this miserable little foreigner will ruin you completely unless you drive him out of the house pretty quickly." The second recording of Plutarch clearly relates to the event as well, and is a cute little anecdote if nothing else. After seeing Aristagoras having his shoes put on by one of his servants, she said, "Father, the stranger has no hands." These recordings by Plutarch, whether true or false, definitively speak to the fibre of the woman, as I imagine her at any rate, who would go on to marry Leonidas, and who would also go on to tell a foreign woman that only Spartan women gave birth to real men. As for Aristagoras, he had more luck with the Athenians who agreed to offer assistance in his planned revolt. This action, the Ionian Revolt, ultimately failed, and the Athenians, along with the Ionians, merely bloodied the nose and annoyed the rage and honour of Darius. This led to him eventually deciding to punish the mainland Greeks en masse a decade later, in what we call today the Greco-Persian Wars. In 494 BCE, Cleomenes, at the head of another Spartan army, invaded Argos, which had been unusually quiet since the last time the Spartans defeated them a half a century prior at the Battle of the Champions. The casus belli for the invasions are equivocal. It was perhaps due to a resurgent Argos, who after two generations had regained enough strength to threaten Sparta or the League. It could have been merely a flight of fancy on behalf of Cleomenes, who was thoroughly the central power within Sparta and could more or less do as he pleased. Most likely, however, is the possibility that Argos had, or was close to, Medizing. Having terrible relationships with her neighbours, namely Sparta and Athens, it would make sense that the Argives courted Persian support. They infamously remained neutral during the Persian invasions, but had Cleomenes not invaded and crushed their armies in the 490s, they may have gone over to Persia, as so many other Greek city-states did. Herodotus states that it was a Delphic oracle that spurred Cleomenes into action, having received word from the Pythia that he would take Argos. The historian also states that the Argives, around the same time, received an oracle as well, predicting their loss in a future engagement. The Spartan force marched to the plain of Thyrea, and from there proceeded north to Argos. They were intercepted en route by the Argive army, numbering several thousand men. With the two armies squaring off, the Argives, due to the oracle, became nervous of the engagement. Instead of ordering the assault, the generals ordered their men to follow the commands of the opposing Spartan heralds. It seems a strange thing to do, but if it actually occurred, it would have been initially quite confusing for Cleomenes and his forces. Every time a command was issued, the Argives would move in kind. It surely seemed like their enemies were predicting the Spartans' every evolution. Ever wily, Cleomenes eventually caught on to this tactic and instructed his men that when next the herald gave a command to take the midday meal, to instead attack. It worked perfectly, and as the Argives received instruction from the Spartan heralds, they took to eating and drinking. The Spartans attacked and killed a great many of them. The survivors fled to a nearby hill, surrounded by a thick grove of trees, and took refuge there. The Spartans encircled their position. From some of the deserters, Cleomenes learned the names of the Argives who had holed up on the wooded hill. He sent a herald into the grove to tell the individuals so named that he had received their ransom. Apparently the going rate, at the time, was 2 minae for each prisoner, a rather meagre sum. Convinced their deliverance was at hand, around 50 Argives proceeded from their place of safety. Cleomenes had them butchered where they stood. The grove was, as mentioned, quite thick, and the remaining Argives couldn't at first see what had happened to their compatriots. One particularly quick-thinking soldier climbed a tree and witnessed the treatment those falsely ransomed had received. Needless to say, the Argives stopped leaving after that. Not to be denied his desired slaughter, Cleomenes then ordered the helots accompanying his army to pile dry sticks and branches around the grove and then set the whole lot on fire, burning the remaining men of Argos alive. It's a horrendous act, and must have been horrifying to behold. Not for Cleomenes, though. He found the time to ask one of the deserters to what god was the grove sacred. When he was told that it was sacred to Argos, the king let out a groan, as he perceived that this was what the oracle of Delphi had meant when he was told he would take Argos. In all, it is said around 6,000 Argive hoplites were killed in the engagement, and better referred to as the butchery of Sepia, rather than the battle. Dismissing the larger part of his army, and keeping with him only 1,000 of the best, Cleomenes marched on Argos. Not to make war, but to offer sacrifice at the Temple of Hera there. He was informed by the head priest that strangers were not allowed within the confines of the sanctuary. As always, though, Cleomenes did as he pleased, instructing the helots to not only drag the priest out, but give him a good thrashing as well. The king proceeded within and offered sacrifice. Only after this did he return to Sparta. I think it interesting that in both episodes of sacrilege and impiety, first burning the grove and second whipping the priest, Cleomenes had the helots perform his dirty work. The red on his ledger, particularly where the gods are concerned, was really starting to mount up. Back in Sparta, his enemies, of which Demaratus was foremost, levelled a charge of corruption against him and brought him before the ephorate. The accusation was one of bribery, that the Argives bribed the king into not taking their city. In his defence, he stated that the oracle of Delphi had offered him Argos, and Argos in the form of the grove he had taken. To further support this, he told the ephorate that his purpose in sacrificing at Hera's temple was to ensure he had interpreted Apollo's will correctly. Cleomenes said that as he offered up to the goddess, a flame shot from the bust of her statue, and he knew with certainty that he was not to capture Argos the city. Interestingly, he also said that had the flame shot from the statue's head, it would have meant he was to proceed in conquering the city. Herodotus must have absolutely loved these little details, being a man of omen and oracle. It was good enough for the ephorate, who fully acquitted the king of all charges. Following the failure of the Ionian revolt, wrapping up in around 493 BCE, King Darius began to plan his invasion of Greece to punish those who deigned to spit in his face. He sent envoys to the various polis, asking for the customary tokens of submission, jars of water and earth to impart the city's subservience to Persia. These ambassadors received assurances of alliance from a great many of the Greek cities. Famously, though, the Athenians and the Spartans not only refused the offer of the Persian king, they summarily executed his officials as well. In a scene recreated by Frank Miller in his graphic novel 300, the Spartans threw the Persian envoys down a well, telling them that they'll find plenty of water down there. That's pretty cool. It was clear by these actions that Darius would have to invade to enforce his will. He ordered the Ionian cities recently pacified to prepare ships to transport his armies. One of the cities that submitted to Persia was the powerful island nation state of Aegina. In the years before the naval might of Athens had risen, Aegina was a mighty thalassocracy, who was in constant antagonisms with Athens. That they offered the tokens of submission was taken by the Athenians as a direct threat to themselves, assuming correctly in my mind that the Aeginetans would use Persian muscle to destroy their rival. The Athenians leaked knowledge of the Medizing Aeginetans to the Spartans. The island was, de facto, if not de jure, already a member of the Peloponnesian League. Cleomenes had by now, if he had not done so years previous, declared himself and Sparta thoroughly anti-Persian. Dead Persian envoys at the bottom of a well left little doubt as to that. It wouldn't do for one of his allies and vassals to go against it. He manned a fleet, sailed to Aegina, and attempted to arrest some of its prominent citizens. He met resistance there, resistance that had the hallmarks of interference by Demaratus. The Aeginetans exclaimed that Cleomenes was operating extra-constitutionally, and were that not so, both kings would be present to enforce the will of Sparta. As it currently stood, the Spartan had no authority, and his mission was unsuccessful, whereupon he began his trek back home, with steam whistling from his ears. Meanwhile, back in Sparta, Demaratus was, in the words of Herodotus, talking against Cleomenes at every chance he had. Once the Argead king returned home, and had received word of his co-king's perfidy, he decided that enough was enough. Hatching a plot to rid himself of the Demaratus-shaped thorn in his side, he entered into an agreement with Leotychithus, or son of the fortunate lion in English, who was a kinsman to Demaratus and a member of the Eropontid house. The agreement was simple. Leotychithus would gain the throne if he would in turn support Cleomenes on Aegina. The terms were accepted. Now Leotychithus had his own personal enmity for the Eropontid king. Demaratus had taken his fiancée by force and married her himself. It's hard to read into this act, as Spartan marriages often involved a symbolic type of rape, but this instance seemed to go above and beyond mere symbolism. Demaratus appears to be particularly skilled in ticking off his peers, and was about to come back to bite him. Leotychithus made charges against his kinsman before the Ephorate, charges of illegitimacy that we well understand considering the story of Demaratus's birth. The Ephors weren't so sure. Ariston had recognized the birth as legitimate and raised the boy as a crown prince after all. So, they consulted the Delphic Oracle. Cleomenes was one step ahead and had already bribed the prophetess into supporting his claims. When the Spartan messengers returned, they told the Ephorate what the Pythia had told them. Demaratus was illegitimate and was forced to immediately renounce his throne. He wasn't exiled, however, and never was by the state. Instead, he was offered a ceremonial position as the head of the Gymnopaedia festival, a token, though not insignificant, post. Adding insult to injury, the new Eropontid king wasted no time in rubbing salt into the wounds of the former king. He asked Demaratus how it felt to be a mere official, now, after having ruled Sparta as a king. It was too much for Demaratus, who contrived to flee to Persia to take up residence there. Before he did, Herodotus remarkably records an interview he had with his mother prior to leaving. Having sacrificed and made oaths, he had her tell him the truth of his birth under pain of sacrilege. We unfortunately don't know her name, but the mother told her son the story of his conception as she understood it. 3 nights after she came into Ariston's house, he entered her bandchamber and lay with her. As he left, the figure revealed itself to be an apparition of the hero Astrobacchus, whose shrine lay nearby to the house. Afterwards, the real Ariston entered and also lay with his wife. So, his mother told Demaratus he was either the child of Ariston or of Astrobacchus. I don't personally buy the story, even though I find it very compelling. Full-term pregnancies were no guarantee of a baby surviving for most of history. For a baby to be born at 6 months and survive is highly unlikely in the ancient world. I find it more probable that, as Ariston had initially suspected, his new wife was pregnant by her cuckolded husband. For Demaratus, he finished his days in Persian Anatolia, where some of his descendants, aptly named Eurysthenes and Procles, named after the progenitors of the Spartan royal houses, still lived. They were, in fact, sources for Herodotus in his histories, which goes a long way to explaining why Herodotus was so anti-Cleomenian, and why he gave Demaratus a pass for his betrayal of Greece. If we would like to know a little more about Demaratus, I've recently posted a blog entry about his downfall and subsequent affairs in Persia. You can check it out on the website. Now, with no one standing in his way, Cleomenes returned to Aegina in 491, attained promises of submission, arrested 10 of her most prominent citizens, and deposited them in an Athenian prison, the last place they would have liked to have been. It was to be his last act as sanctioned king. Word of the king's Delphic sacrilege preceded his return to Sparta, where the Ephors attempted to imprison and depose him for his crimes. Cleomenes fled to the uplands of Arcadia, and in doing so basically admitted his guilt. The Spartans were alarmed to discover that he was raising an army in the north, so they allowed him some clemency to return to his home city. It was a ruse, and he was immediately placed in prison, and on the orders of his half-brothers, Leonidas and Cleombrotus, he was shackled in chains. It was also reported that Cleomenes had by this stage lost his mind, taking to fits of ranting, raving, and poking his staff at passers-by. A helot was set to guard over him, but the former king had lost none of his oratory powers, it seems. He convinced the helot to give him a knife. He then proceeded to slice and eviscerate himself in an act of bloody suicide. Next in line, Leonidas had already assumed the Argead throne and married Cleomenes' daughter, the aforementioned Gorgo. Herodotus, whilst talking about Doreus' end, mentioned somewhat ironically that had he been patient and stayed in Sparta, the glory he was chasing would have been his as the Persian Wars came about. Instead, that honour went to Leonidas. That is a story for another time. Uncle H offers no fewer than 4 different explanations for Cleomenes' death. The Argives say it was for his butchering of their men and burning the sacred grove. The Athenians say it was for revenge over some impiety he showed whilst invading their territories. The story I just told you above is the official Spartan narrative, which is perhaps designed to absolve them of a regicide. Leonidas certainly had much to gain from his half-brother's demise, and his marrying Cleomenes' daughter implies she may have been complicit in these designs as well. But the story, the one Herodotus likes the best, is that it was punishment for his corruption of the Delphic Oracle and removing his co-king through foul means. This, combined with his 20-year obsession in taking neat wine, all resulted in the madness and divine retribution Cleomenes suffered in his final days. Whichever, it doesn't truly matter. Cleomenes' reign came to an end in a violent fashion, not dissimilar to some of the violence perpetrated by the man himself during his rule. There is an aphorism, subscribed to by many Greek authors, that you should look to the end of a person's life before judging it. This is unfair, I feel, in the case of Cleomenes. Assuredly, he was impious, ruthless, autocratic, and often unsuccessful in his endeavours. But nevertheless, he set Sparta firmly on the path of resistance to Persia. In a moment of kindness, Herodotus claims that making Sparta anti-Persian was the greatest service ever done for the ancient Hellenes. I think that is a fitting legacy for Cleomenes I, Argead king of Sparta. What a story. I really wasn't sure how that one would pan out, but I'm very pleased with where it has ended up. I hope you all enjoyed listening to it as much as I enjoyed writing and recording. Next up, as we'll be dealing primarily with the Greco-Persian Wars for the next block, I'll be doing an episode exclusively about the Persian Empire. Delving into the history of this mighty state, and bringing that story right up to the 490 BCE mark. I'll have some help with this one, and we'll interview Trevor Cully from the History of Persia podcast. It's always nice to have someone else do the heavy lifting, and really don't think I'd be able to do the Persian story justice without some help. So there you have it, dear listeners. Another one down, plenty more to come. I invite you all to join me on Sunday, May the 8th, for episode 34, The History of Persia with Trevor Cully. Until then, you know the drill. Take good care, and speak soon. If you'd like to contribute to the show, please head over to www.spartanhistorypodcast.com, where you see on the homepage buttons for Buy Me a Coffee and PayPal. Alternatively, you can go to www.buymeacoffee.com/Spartan History or www.paypal.me/Spartan History. You can find me on Twitter at Spartan_History and on Facebook too at Spartan History Podcast. If you like this episode and keen to hear more, subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you catch your pods from. Leave a review too. See you next time.